Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Branko Marcetic, a staff writer with Jacobin Magazine, who examines working class discontent as a major factor contributing to Vice President Kamala Harris's election defeat to disgrace former President Donald Trump. Victor Picard, professor of media policy at the University of Pennsylvania, who assesses corporate media's many failures, covering the 2024 presidential election campaign. And Mazen Kumsia, director of the Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability at Bethlehem University, who talks about Israeli settlers escalating violence and property takeovers in the occupied West Bank. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Long before November 5th, there were warning signs of Donald Trump's coming victory in the 2024 presidential election. Trump, in part, won by boosting voter turnout in dark red rural counties in swing states while Democrats' votes were flat. Support for Vice President Kamala Harris fell by 12 million votes across the nation compared to Democratic turnout 4 years ago. Barn Raiser Media reports that early voting turnout broke records in Republican strongholds in states from Georgia to Nebraska. While the Harris campaign and their political action committees spent over $1 billion, they failed to roll out a detailed plan to get out the vote in rural America until mid-October. Political observers question the Harris campaign's decision to feature former right-wing GOP Congresswoman Liz Cheney and billionaire celebrity Mark Cuban in campaign rallies across the nation to attract moderate Republicans. But the campaign mostly ignored the issues important to rural farmers and working families, such as giant meatpacking plants polluting community water supplies, big agriculture colluding in a sham government-funded carbon pipeline scheme, and the big pharma-created opioid crisis that still brings thousands of overdose deaths to rural America. Young people across Africa are campaigning to expel old guard governments angry about corruption and unemployment. In diamond-rich Botswana, the ruling Democratic Party was defeated by an insurgent movement led by 54-year-old Duma Boko, whose Democratic Change Coalition won a majority of seats in parliament. After 50 years in power, the ruling party came in last. While Botswana's outgoing president, Mogwetsi Masisi, quickly conceded defeat, in nearby Mozambique, at least 11 people were killed following the ruling Frelimo Party presidential candidate Daniel Chapo's claim he had won more than 70% of the vote in October. Civil society groups accuse Frelimo of vote rigging, which the government in power since 1975 denies. There's now concern political violence may spread to Zambia, which holds national elections on November 27th. The ruling SWAPO party lost its two-thirds parliamentary majority in the 2019 elections, and there's now fears of instability when SWAPO Party Liberation War veteran Netumbo Nandi-Ndatwa, who would be the nation's first woman head of state, faces off against Panduleni Itula, who founded the opposition Independent Patriots for Change party after being expelled from SWAPO. Many patients have experienced the difficulty in finding a psychologist, a therapist, or an addiction specialist covered by their insurance policy. The networks used by major insurance companies often leave patients frustrated since their provider directories are full of doctors not accepting new patients, wrong phone numbers, or physicians who dropped out of the insurance network years ago. The cause of what's been called ghost networks is usually low insurance reimbursement rates. According to The Guardian, lawyers for frustrated patients filed a class action suit against Anthem Blue Cross of New York for operating such a ghost network. Lawyers who called the first 100 mental health providers listed in the Anthem network could only schedule appointments with 7 providers. The plaintiffs accuse Anthem of operating a deceptive advertising campaign intended to lure people into their plans. As America experiences a broad mental health crisis, studies by the U.S. Senate Finance Committee and the Government Accounting Office have concluded that most mental health providers in insurance networks were not available to book appointments. Minnesota Democratic Senator Tina Smith maintains these are deceptive business practices and these insurance companies should be held accountable in the courts. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
After Donald Trump's victory, there's been a flood of explanations and finger-pointing as to why Vice President Kamala Harris lost this important election to an unpopular, twice-impeached traitorous coup plotter and convicted felon. Among the reasons cited are America's long history of racism and misogyny that has undermined support for women presidential candidates, with Harris being of both Black and South Asian descent. Other explanations include Joe Biden's very late decision to leave the race, giving Harris little time to introduce herself to voters, and strong public opposition to the Biden-Harris administration's unconditional support for Israel's vicious war in Gaza that's killed tens of thousands of Palestinian civilians. It's also been pointed out that after the post-COVID pandemic explosion of inflation that's eroded working families' buying power around the world, almost all incumbent governments that stood for elections have been booted out of office. But after the U.S. November 5th election, progressive independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders had his own explanation for Harris's loss when he said in a statement, quote, "It should come as no great surprise that a Democratic Party which has abandoned working class people would find that the working class has abandoned them," unquote. Your reporter spoke with Bronco Marchetich, a staff writer with Jacobin Magazine, who concludes that the vice president's failure to effectively address working-class economic discontent was a major factor, contributing to her loss of support among virtually all of America's diverse demographic groups.
I think the Trump campaign this election was one of the nastiest, most scurrilous political campaigns I think I have seen in my life. The attacks and scapegoating of immigrants and practically every vulnerable group under the sun, often very hateful rhetoric, a real anger behind it. It was very disturbing. We saw what Trump often tries to do, which is to stir up resentments among people and divide people. And I think that it, to an extent, did work for him. But I think what is being not seen in the aftermath of this, if you listen to a lot of the analysis and rhetoric from Democratic officials, from high-profile media commentators, it's a very simple explanation. It's one that the voters have told us again and again and again. They are not happy in this economy. It is not working for them. There is a significant amount of material hardship going on right now. And what happens in U.S. elections when one party is presiding over poor economic conditions and you have a presidential election, the voters reject that party. They punish them and they bring the other side in hoping for change. It's what happened in 2020. It's what happened in 2008, in 2008 when Obama won. You could go through American history to find similar examples. And look, this is what voters were saying in poll after poll after poll for years going into the election, that the economy was not working for them and that that was going to be the main thing that was going to motivate their voting intention. They said that they were unhappy with the Biden administration and that they were particularly unhappy with its economic handling. And after the election, the exit polls, and we have many, not just exit polls, but post-election polls of people who voted, people say the exact same thing. It's the people who overwhelmingly were unhappy with the economy and saw it as their biggest priority who ended up voting for Trump. And some of those voters are not just white voters. Trump improved his share of the electorate with practically every group under the sun, particularly Muslim voters. And we can talk about that later on, too, the impact of the Gaza genocide and how that demoralized certain Democratic voting constituencies. But ultimately, this was a wave election that rejected the party in power that had failed to address what they've been saying for years, which was that they were really struggling to keep their heads above water in an economy where the cost of living has skyrocketed over the past few years.
Bronco, voters in many of these states that went all in for Trump also voted for minimum wage referendums. They voted for paid sick leave referendums and pro-union referendums as well. They also split their tickets, often supporting Democratic senators in red states that went for Trump. And there was an interesting editorial that I know you and many of our listeners are aware of, and that was conservative New York Times columnist David Brooks, who wrote in an editorial titled, "Voters to Elites, Do You See Me Now?" And in part, he said, "I'm a moderate. I like it when Democratic candidates run to the center. But I have to confess that Harris did that pretty effectively, and it didn't work. Maybe the Democrats have to embrace a Bernie Sanders-style disruption, something that will make people like me feel uncomfortable." I thought that was telling, coming from a conservative columnist. What do you think?
Clearly, David Brooks, whatever his ideological leanings, he is looking at reality as it is. The thing that we have been told so many times, that the way to win elections, particularly against a far-right or extreme candidate, is you run to the center. Harris ran to the center. The New York Times called it a Wall Street-approved campaign. She lost. She lost miserably. This is a losing strategy. And so he's right. You know, in many ways, you can trace the seeds of this defeat in that moment in February 2020 when Barack Obama got on the phone with Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar, and he suggested they pull out before the South Carolina primary so that Joe Biden would inherit their voters and be the only challenge to Sanders and ultimately paved his way for the nomination. That was a demoralizing victory to the grassroots movement behind Bernie Sanders, you know, Sanders as well, because of the kind of figure he is, and also because of the movement behind him. He had the loyalty of many of the voters that Democrats lost in this election. Now, look, I'm not saying renominate Bernie Sanders, but I think the party needs to look at what he has been saying for the past 8 years, which is that the way that you win elections, you have to try and actually appeal to the working class. You have to give them something to vote for that will actually improve their lives. You know, Trump did that. Unfortunately, the message he used is a vile and, I think, racist one, blaming every single problem in American life today on undocumented immigrants, which is, of course, absurd. But it was an economic message, ultimately. You know, the Democrats didn't really have one. So I'm glad to see that this conversation is at least being held, even if it is far too late to, you know, to go back in time and try and replicate the kind of movement that Brooks is talking about. But maybe it will cause some rethinking. If that doesn't happen, I think a lot of Democratic voters have the right to be really, really angry, because this is the one thing that the party promises them, that they'll win elections and stop the far right from winning. And they have failed to deliver that twice now.
That was Bronco Marchetich, a staff writer with Jacobin Magazine. Find his recent articles interpreting the results of the 2024 presidential election by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As Donald Trump stood before the American people campaigning for a return to the White House, the twice-impeached convicted felon and coup-plotting insurrectionist found liable for sexual assault, blatantly use racist, misogynist, and xenophobic rhetoric to incite hatred and division among the electorate. Media coverage of Trump's incendiary rallies too often soft-pedaled and sanitized his toxic words, while declining to aggressively examine the aging candidate's bizarre behavior that clearly betrayed his cognitive decline. While post-election analysis indicates large numbers of voters chose to support Trump over Vice President Kamala Harris, primarily due to their faith that Trump would do a better job improving the economy and battling inflation, overall, The media dedicated little attention to a serious examination of Trump's sketchy economic policies or his record on economic performance while he was in office. Your reporter spoke with Victor Picard, C. Edwin Baker Professor of Media Policy and Political Economy and co-director at the Media Inequality and Change Center at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication. Here he assesses corporate media's coverage of the 2024 campaign, with a focus on the decline of legacy media, the rise of disinformation, and the growing reach and influence of right-wing bro social media, streaming and podcast sphere, with few resources available, to develop a progressive counterpart and alternative.
They really not only sane-washed his behavior, they really normalized it in various ways. But they also did the things that we knew they were going to do and asked them not to do. The inveterate media critic Jay Rosen was long pleading with media organizations to emphasize not the odds, but the stakes. In other words, don't treat this as another horse race, as you always do. And of course, all too predictably, they did revert back to this kind of horse race approach to our politics. They didn't really look at the policies. It's interesting now you're actually seeing more of an emphasis on the stakes because now we're hearing about, you know, what would mass deportations actually look like? Who is going to get kicked off their health care plans? So now we're starting to see some of the implications of Trump's policy positions and policy plans. But unfortunately, during the campaign leading up to the election, we didn't see enough of that. And we saw the standard, you know, he said, she said, both sidesing of these debates and not enough actual policy analysis.
Professor Picard, I wanted you to comment on the diminishing influence and reach of legacy media, which has quite obviously been replaced now by social media, TikTok, podcasts, YouTube streaming filled with disinformation and misinformation. And it's quite provable that many voters are now uninformed about major issues. In fact, after Election Day, there was an explosion of Google searches on the issue of tariffs, inflation, mass deportation, and fascism, things that these social media outlets did not provide and certainly didn't fact check a lot of the nonsense that was out there from Trump-paid influencers.
Yes, deeply, deeply troubling. Will Bunch had a fantastic column a couple of days ago where he really emphasized this troubling fact that it was these so-called low-information voters that really led to Trump's ascendance, and that people who weren't getting factual information were much more likely to vote for Trump. And what's correlation and what's causation is a legitimate question, but certainly they seem to go at least hand in hand. And this is symptomatic of these deeper structural pathologies. You've already touched on a couple of them, but it is this degradation of our traditional news media. And there's a couple stark examples, data points on this. One is that we've seen the collapse of local journalism over the last two decades. Since the early 2000s, we've lost two-thirds of our newspaper journalists and a third of our newspapers. And the reason why this is especially devastating is that newspapers are still the primary source for original news gathering and original reporting that actually introduces new facts into our discourse. So that is one structural pathology. The other one is that increasingly, people are turning to social media to get their news and information, and that's where they're often finding various forms of mis and disinformation. And of course, one thing we didn't touch on yet is the role of Elon Musk, who is another kind of media oligarch who weaponized Twitter, or now called X, to basically push these far-right politics. So all these things combined, a growing right-wing media sector, various kinds of right-wing influencers and podcasts, these all combine to create a very dangerous media landscape, a landscape within which fascism is allowed to thrive.
That was Victor Picard, C. Edwin Baker Professor of Media Policy and Political Economy and co-director at the Media Inequality and Change Center at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication. Find more analysis and commentary on media's coverage of the 2024 election campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The issue of Gaza and Israel's expanding war into Lebanon and across the Middle East was mostly absent in the U.S. election campaign last week. Vice President Kamala Harris expressed her support for President Biden's policy of totally backing Israel, while Donald Trump was on record urging Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to, quote, finish the job. Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, expressed interest in developing beachfront property in Gaza once the territory is emptied of Palestinians. After more than a year of war, Israel's slaughter of Palestinians in Gaza has killed more than 43,000, 70% of the dead women and children. Despite public opinion polls finding that a majority of Americans support an end to the war in Gaza and suspension of U.S. military aid to Israel, neither Harris or Trump share those views. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Mazen Kumsia, a Palestinian professor at Bethlehem University and founder and director of the Palestine Museum of Natural History. As a dual U.S.-Palestinian citizen, he could have voted in the American election, but declined, saying the only difference between Trump and Harris on the Palestinian genocide is a rhetorical one. Here he describes the impact of Israeli settlers' escalating violence and property takeovers in the West Bank, where he lives near Bethlehem, and shares his dark view of how war could overtake the region.
From October 7, Israel basically had the green light to kill and injure and jail and torture any Palestinians. All previous restrictions were removed, whether it be Red Cross visits to the prison gulags or the settlers being restrained in any fashion. And the settlers are the state, of course, so they were allowed to engage in pogroms. It's a big, big problem. The settlements have expanded. 23 communities were evicted. Palestinian communities were evicted. Thousands of people were made homeless in the West Bank thanks to these evictions. They fall under three categories. One is increased demolitions of Palestinian homes that are supposedly built without a permit, without an Israeli permit, even though it's their own land and Israel doesn't have a right to prevent them. Hundreds of new home demolitions under that category. And then there's the category of communities evicted, like those 23 communities I mentioned, mostly Bedouin communities and villagers in the Jordan Valley and in the South Hebron Hills. And the third category is the category of attacks on homes in the guise of military needs. So going especially in refugee camps, in the north, particularly in Nablus, Jenin, Tulkarm, where D9 bulldozers, these are fortified bulldozers that can knock out a whole house in one swoop. They were going in, destroying infrastructure, including houses, or attacking houses that they claimed there were terrorists hiding in. So those are the three categories of ethnic cleansing activities they engaged in the West Bank in the past year.
I know another big issue is the increase in the number of Palestinians who are being held in Israeli jails and under harsher conditions post-October 7th. There used to be 8,000 or 9,000, but now?
That was the number before. Now it's probably tripled or quadrupled. But we don't know because they kidnapped thousands of people from Gaza. Some of them they released, some of them they didn't release. They refused to give numbers. They refused to give any statistics. They refused to allow Red Cross visits.
Mazen Kumsia, do you think this war is making Israel more or less secure, or neither?
Israel is finished, in my opinion, and they can be finished one way or the other. The two options for them to be finished is either the option of the BRICS country, Russia, China, Brazil, India, South Africa, who had just finished their meetings in Russia and decided to already take a strong position and supplying arms to Iran and all of this. And Israel, even with the support of the U.S., they will not be able to withstand the support of the U.S. and NATO, which has been 100% whatever Israel asks for. But anyway, they will be finished as a country, and we will have human rights, and we will have equality, and Jews, Christians, Muslims will live together here in peace. That's one option. A second option, we go to a full-fledged global war, a nuclear war, which we are very close in. I don't know if you noticed, but the Iranian regime now had, through their key strategic committee chair, a general, I forget his name, he said Iran can make nuclear weapons today if they choose to. And Khamenei's fatwa said we should not make nuclear weapons. But our new strategy is if Iran feels threatened, then we can and we will develop nuclear weapons as a deterrent. And if Israel uses its nuclear weapons, we will use our nuclear weapons. And we have the ballistic missiles, and we have the ability to wipe that entity off the face of the earth. That means a global war, of course, if Israel chooses to continue down the path it's been going in, which I have been pushing for a regional war instead of ending the slaughter in Gaza.
That was Mazen Qumsia, director of the Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability at Bethlehem University, and director of the Palestine Museum of Natural History. Find more news and commentary on Israel's brutal war in Gaza and West Bank occupation by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WXOJ in Florence, Massachusetts, KHOI in Ames, Iowa, KMUD in Garberville, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.